One of the lunar orbiters located the flag planted by Neil Armstrong, and the visual of that flag shows that it's still standing, but it no longer has the color. The ultraviolet exposure has bleached that flag, and so now that flag looks pure white. So if they got enough resolution to visualize the flag that Neil Armstrong planted, I suspect that most of the other craft have also been visualized. And it's not very exciting information this many years downrange. It doesn't appear in your news. You know the way the news works these days. If it bleeds, it leads. Well, that doesn't bleed. It's not new information. So I don't think we're missing visualizations of those craft on the surface of surface of the moon. Back to you for a comment on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick. But I just think if we could dispel that, we could get rid of these idiots that are occupying YouTube with these stupid comments and just prove to them, I believe it was there like when. I think it landed. I think they did their job. And also, I don't remember which mission inserted the laser reflector, whether that was 11 or was that 12. Do you know, Dick?
Yeah, I'm not sure. However, even if all of those lunar orbiter pictures were made public, to a person who is absolutely convinced that all of the Apollo mission was a hoax, that would be absolutely no proof to him, John. He would think that it was a pure Photoshop creation. So showing those pictures wouldn't change their mind. When a person is sufficiently positive of a particular opinion, he can find all kinds of ways of reinterpreting the new data you've given him. Back to you on that one, John.
Hey, KC2QIQ with a comment?
That's a good call, Dick. Go back to you, Dick.
You got it, Glenn.
Right back.
Just one little comment about that, and that was just that there were some things, I guess, after, let's say, you know, Apollo 17, where we no longer went to the moon missions, and all of a sudden Skylab became, you know, a big focus, Hubble became a big focus, and the moon kind of just all of a sudden disappeared from the news, from the media, from everything. But from people that I've spoke to, other information that I've actually cataloged since that time, remember I was born in 62, so I did most of this like during the 80s, and you know, kind of continue to keep my eye on it. And what I've found out over the years is that the study of the moon did not stop after Apollo 17. There were many, many other satellites that went up there and did a lot more research. And most of it, you just can't get your fingers on, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I think an awful lot of that you can get your fingers on, John. I mean, Glenn, if you go to the right place. How many of the NASA and JPL sites have you visited where there's a tremendous number of spacecraft that you can select that particular spacecraft and then find the engineering data as to how it was created, when was it launched, what did it find, how long did it last? If you go to the right site, there's a tremendous amount of information available. What do you think is missing, Glenn? Go ahead.
Moon mapping data, certain things about the you know, surface of the moon, certain dimensions of it, different surfaces, and pretty much all photographs.
When I had a chance to, after Apollo 16, was it between 15 and 16? I think it was after 16. I had a chance to go to Houston, went to Building 30, the main control center in Houston, went into the actual place that you see on the television screen during those missions, and one of the maps of the moon that was on one of the desks showing where the astronauts are going to be and what they're going to do next. The particular guide I had knew who I was, knew what I had done, picked up that map and handed it to me. So I've seen maps, I've seen high-resolution maps of at least a portion of the moon where the astronauts were going to go. I guarantee those are available. I think I've seen advertisements for where you can buy a high-resolution lunar map, just like you can buy high-resolution Mars maps. So I didn't say it's easy. I think they know that not a high percentage of the population is going to request that. It's not a big selling item. They'd much the general public would much rather buy a photograph of their favorite sports figure than they would rather buy a picture of the moon, if you know what I mean. So you and I could be unhappy about the fact that that very important information is not more popular among the general public. But I don't think there's a great deal missing. You think there is. I'll keep my eye out for some of the stuff, and I'll bring it to your attention as I...
Dick, I'd appreciate it. If you do come across any of those links, I'd really be interested in pursuing it.
Okay, which one are you most interested in? A greater information about the lunar missions, the Mars missions, the Jupiter missions, the Saturn missions? Which missions are you most interested in? Or the solar missions? Which missions are you most interested in, Glenn?
Robotic moon mapping, moon dimension, and moon photographs.
Okay. You're a moon man. All right, I'll keep an eye out for that.
Dick, I know it exists. I just don't think you can get your fingers on it.
I don't think anybody has called it classified and trying to keep it away from you for that reason, though, John. Glenn, do you think it's being kept away from you for reasons of sensitivity of some kind, as far as classification? Go ahead.
Kelly, 2PVW.
I have a suspicion that there's more study going on with the moon than is publicly aware. And, you know, typically when there's something like that where, you know, it may be somewhat available and then you kind of like, you know, sniff it and you start moving in that direction, they kind of like play the shell game and they move it to another spot. So something tells me that there's probably still something going on there that people don't want people like me to find. K4IW, KC2QAQ.
Let me give you an example of something going on here, Glenn. When Sputnik was first launched in 1957, and mankind had put a object in orbit around this planet, and it happened to be an object launched by the Soviet Union, for a short period of time, all kinds of paranoia took place in the United States. Boy, they can put something in orbit. And once it's in orbit, all they've got to do is let go of one of these things. It'll drop straight down on the Earth, and they can bomb anything they want. People used to believe that. To really launch something from orbit and to hit a particular target on the Earth is a hell of a lot more difficult than you think. To put something on the moon and to say that, aha, I've conquered this chunk of soil, 250,000 miles away, and now I can use it as a launching pad and throw things down on the Earth and create a whole lot of mischief. The military use of the moon, it is my opinion, it's got 1% of the military usefulness that some paranoid thinking people believe it has. If you had the world's best base of some kind on the moon, do you believe that would allow you to easily conquer some other chunk of land on planet Earth? I doubt it. Let me send it back to you. What do you think is the military application of that lunar surface, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I don't really have a clue, Dick. As I said, and I don't think anybody wants me to have a clue. So, as I said, it's something that my suspicion is that there's a lot of technology out there, and you know, it's a place, the moon is a place that's being studied, and a lot of technology is being involved, and a lot of technology is being used, and don't think that they really want any of it exposed, and mine is just pure curiosity, you know, pure and simple curiosity, and as I said, you know, I don't think that, you know, people really want me to see what they're doing, and that's really what it's all about. You know, is it a military thing? Maybe, maybe not, who knows. But as I said, you know, there's just certain things that about the moon I'd like to know a lot more about. And I know the information's out there, but for certain reasons it's been elusive for me to actually, you know, find out what it's all about. And I think that there is reasons for it. What they are, who knows? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I think the military possibilities being well established on the moon are nowhere near as valuable as a naive person would think. Let me show you something else. Choose the most valuable substance you can think of. Gold, silver, platinum, uranium, plutonium, whatever. Diamond. Whatever you think is valuable. Or some other combination that's even more valuable than that. Gallium arsenide or whatever. Indium phosphide. Whatever you think is valuable. If there was a tremendous amount of it on the moon, and you think you're going to go there and mine it and bring it back and get rich quick, I say it's out of the question. If you calculate how many megabucks it takes to launch a few pounds into orbit, and you've got to go a hell of a lot further to get it onto the lunar surface without crunching it up, and then you collect whatever valuable material there is there, change it in any way you want to, and bring it back to the Earth, and you think you're going to get rich quick. No matter what is there, if you look at the total cost of getting it and bringing it back, I don't care if you do it with a manned mission, with a robot mission, or whatever, with current technology, no way in hell. It almost would be cheaper to use your particle accelerator and one atom at a time by transmutation, you make whatever you want to make. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's almost that bad. So no matter what is there, I don't care how valuable it is, it's so far away and so expensive to get there, it ain't got no value to you on planet Earth today. 100 years from now, with different technology, maybe. Right now, no way. John, KC2.
Okay, can I give you a puzzle on this one?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think you've probably read, like most people, what the actual diameter of the moon is, its relative orbit, its size. But here's an interesting thing. There's a mass calculation for the moon that it's very, very interesting. I don't want to say too much to corrupt the puzzle for you, but see if you can calculate the mass of the moon. And don't go by what's published. Actually, take a look at the real orbit, the size, the distance, locations, and come up with a number that you think the mass of the moon is, and then maybe we can compare notes one day. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Enough said.
What do you use for raw data for calculating the mass of the moon? Is it the amount of wobble of the Earth, the amount of the height of the tides? What is the raw data that you use to calculate mass of moon, Glenn? Go ahead.
I can't spoil this for you. And as I said, when I started digging and I started asking the questions, that's when the information started getting pulled for me. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I'm quiet.
Can I change the subject?
Do you believe there is a great discrepancy between what is published and what is real? Is that what you're saying?
Check it out. KC2QIQ. I think Wesley has a question.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, John is the next person on the list. KC2WGB. Go ahead, John.
Well, we could shoot all of those minerals down with a rail gun, put it in orbit around the Earth. That's what they want to do. That's what they're working on. But just for comedy relief, don't forget, according to quantum theory, the moon's only there when we look at it. So, much ado about nothing. Good point, though, Glenn.
Yeah, I have a question to Glenn.
Go ahead.
I don't know, Glenn, if you had a chance to see my video. We spoke about that video thanks to kindness of John and Dick. 5 o'clock in the morning for the whole night. There is a very interesting structure. It's a motorized two C-shaped ferrite core, very similar to Glenn transformer. You have two coils. Those two coils are winded on each one of the halves of the C's. Now, the only one C is motorized. Two coils are connected in series. So basically, if the permeability of ferrite is 2,000 and the permeability of air is 1, we're playing with Q. That is my belief. My question to you is, We have two structures like this, one on one leg, one on the other leg. Would you believe that, how that structure works? Maybe Dick will tell you a little bit more about it if you don't understand. Because we're not changing the number of winds, we're not changing the inductors, we're changing on one coil only, just the coupling of the cores. Now, what's going on to the eddy current? The core is never closed. It does have a 1/64 of an inch when it's closed. Dick, back to you, and then to Glenn.
Yeah, when you do get a chance to see the movie that Wes is talking about, picture a transformer wound on C cores. The primary is on the left-hand C, the secondary is on the right-hand C. A pair of these transformer-like things side by side. There is a gear motor mechanism that allows you to change the gap between the cores, and you can make that gap go from, looks like less than a 64th of an inch, all the way up to a good half of an inch or so. And the secondary windings are used in some kind of a series operation. The primary goes to a input connector on the front panel. Can you think of a reason why somebody would intentionally change the air gap between the portion of a C that's the primary and the portion of the C that's the secondary? Can you think of a reason for doing that? Our guess is that it's shifting either the resonant frequency, for sure, the self-resonant frequency of primary and secondary, and or the coupling coefficient. You might have some opinions on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
The main reason why somebody would vary in a voltage transformer the gap in between is because a transformer, typically when you have zero air gap inside of it and very, very high permeability, must reset on every cycle. And you're limited to your volt seconds before saturation. So in other words, if you have a peak volt second in one quadrant, you have to reset the volt seconds on the next cycle in order to prevent the transformer from saturating. Now, if we were to take an air gap and you open the air gap up, now what basically will happen is the inductance associated to the increased air gap will reduce the A sub L, that's the inductance per turn, on the windings. So by opening up that air gap, the inductance is dropping, but what it allows you to do is it allows you to hold a higher flux density in one direction without saturating the core. So let's say if the gap was zero, let me let it drop for a second. If the gap were zero and the material had a saturation flux density of 4,000 Gauss, if you start opening up the air gap, what you can do is you can start running unequal volt seconds. In other words, you can allow your pulses to go more positive in one quadrant and allow that without, in other words, start creating a DC bias like an inductor on the transformer, so you don't have to have full reset. So that is definitely one of the main reasons in a transformer action for applying an air gap is to extend the peak flux density of the material, because now you no longer have to worry about the flux density of just the fixed cross-sectional area of the and the number of turns on the ferrite. Now you've got the additional air gap, so you can actually store energy in the air gap and use it as an inductor function and run the flux density higher in one quadrant without saturating the core. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Well, Glenn, we're not dealing with a transformer on each one of the legs. Whole structure acts as a transformer, but one leg only that consists from two C-shapes and two coils. Those two coils are connected in series, and you regulate the gap in each one independently. So we're not dealing with the transformer, we're talking about each one of the legs. Back to you.
Yeah, this will become a little bit clearer when you get a chance to see that movie, Glenn. And I think I agree with you that if you put DC current through a high permeability material, DC current through a winding, you tend to saturate that winding, and as you bring an air gap involved, you reduce the total reluctance of the pass. The same amount of ampere turns will give you a hell of a lot less saturation. You can bring it out of saturation. And the way you put the DC current into the, let's say, the primary winding of a transformer, is two different ways. You can literally pour DC current along with your AC signal, or if your AC signal is non-symmetric, if, for instance, a square wave that spends more time positive than negative, that really is the equivalent of a DC current. So I see no reason for them to be pouring DC current through that front panel connector. Using non-symmetric waveforms, yes, or changing the frequency of resonance, yes. When you look at the other portions of the movie, you'll see that I think change of resonant frequency is the main reason for moving the C-cores with these gear motors. You'll notice that another portion of this network that Wesley bought for a very cheap price was a very large copper coil, has the equivalent of a primary and a secondary. The primary copper coil with this great big doorknob capacitor in series with it is a major resonator. Let me drop. Inside of that large copper coil with about 10 turns are two other rotary objects. One of them is, let me call it a five-turn secondary that can be rotated like a goniometer, like a variometer. It can be rotated so that those turns are either parallel to the main copper coil turns or at right angles to them, motorized. Another object inside of the copper coil is an object that looks like about five or six aluminum discs all on a single rod, and those aluminum discs can be oriented in such a way that they are parallel to the turns of the copper coil or at right angles. I call that a variable reluctance device. So to tune that great big copper coil with a real variable capacitor added to or subtracted from those doorknobs would be very difficult. To simply change the inductance of the coil by way of these six discs in there that can be rotated is one very crafty idea. And then the variometer thing gives you a variable coupling coefficient between it and an output connector on the front panel. So this whole thing looks like some kind of resonator and maybe multiple frequency combiner. There are portions of the front panel that say, here's where you put in the megahertz signal, here's where you put in the kilohertz signal. So maybe it is a summing device where multiple frequencies are being summed, sort of like a diplexer, duplexer, and or resonating is taking place. Rather unusual looking thing. You might have some questions on what you've heard so far, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, with regard to a resonant oscillator type of circuit, isn't an interesting thing you can do with that type of a circuit. If you have a winding on one side of a magnetic core, and basically you have another winding on the other side, like C core, and basically you're adjusting an air gap in between, and one of those windings on either side, if you wanted to create a C over there in parallel with that winding and create a resonant tank circuit. There's a nice thing about an air gap. Transformers don't like to be into resonance because they cause very, very strange saturation characteristics and overheating, and very, very bad things happen to transformers in resonance. But if the resonance is on the secondary winding and is being tuned by varying the inductance by the Asabel with the air gap, so that as you basically as you close the air gap a little bit, you get higher inductance, open the air gap, you get lower inductance, you could theoretically tune a resonance on one of the windings. Now, if you were to feed in on the other winding, not on the resonant winding, a frequency, and the other side is a resonant tank, when that energy goes through that coupling of that magnetic core, even with the air gap, that energy will combine in the resonant tank side and will find resonance. That, in other words, once that energy starts swinging back and forth, even though it's at a lower frequency or a higher frequency coming in from one winding, the resonant frequency will become the dominant frequency on the other winding with the parallel LC tank.
So there's some interesting things that can be done there. Yes, you can actually make like a frequency smoothing and converter and adjust the resonant frequency by adjusting that air gap on the resonant side of the of that structure. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I've got to guess that there's a slim chance that this thing does a kind of super heterodyne mixing. Under normal circumstances, a mixer will only mix frequency 1 and frequency 2, giving you output frequencies that are different, some of F1 and F2, or the difference of F1 and F2. You only get those other frequencies in the superheterodyne process if something nonlinear is taking place. A varactor diode, a tube that's in saturation, a transformer that's in saturation could do it. You need nonlinearity in order to mix signals to make a third signal. There's a slim possibility this network is doing that. And by moving the cores, changing the amount of saturation, you could now use the magnetic structure as the nonlinear thing in order to do the mixing. Have you ever seen magnetic circuits intentionally partially saturated in order to create the nonlinearity that does a mixing action? Have you ever seen anything like that, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
Actually, I have a transceiver here, Jack, that does just that. It's called an FTDX9000 YAESU. It's my HF receiver. And they do something here called mu tuning. And that's exactly what they do. Basically, they have open circuit windings, and they tune the mu to control the inductance. That's why they're called mu tuning. And you can actually vary the skirts and control that nonlinearity to create filters, resonances, and mixing. All of the above. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, then when you see this, I think it's about a 20-minute movie. Maybe it's a 40-minute movie. 15-minute movie? Okay. When you see this movie and you see the various views that Wes has got of it, top side, front, back, and he applies 24 volts to the motors and actually moves them, he's got a total of 4 motors in there, I think. Motor number 1 moves the air gap on transformer number 1. Motor number 2, transformer number 2. Motor number 3 is the 5 discs that changes the inductance of that coil, the great big copper coil. And motor number 4 is the variometer. And there's a couple of other things. When you look at this box that this thing is in, my goodness, somebody's put a lot of effort into it. A great big... The coil, the copper coil, looks to me like it's got about 8 or 10 turns. It looks like it's a quarter-inch diameter copper tubing, slightly flattened, with doorknob capacitors at one end in series with that coil going to ground. So we're talking about rather high power, rather high Q network. And the covers that go on these boxes have got a million little fingers, a finger stock around the edge to make sure the cover makes extremely good coverage. One of the things I know will happen for sure is that you tune that coil with the cover off and you tune the coil with the cover on, you're going to get very different tuning of that copper coil. But the fact that they have all of this finger stock around the edge of this box, the box to me looks like it's about a foot wide and half a foot in the other two dimensions. So it's got a lot of volume to it with fancy covers. So somebody put a lot of effort into doing this thing. And because one of the output connectors is a 7/16 DIN connector, the thing looks like it's made for the kilowatt level. Back to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Before that, Glenn, I was able to establish the new device, the big box, cost about $40,000. And I've checked exactly how much I paid, $25, not $35 as I told you before, Dick, $25, no shipping cost for the big one. For the other one was $35, no shipping cost. So there are 2 boxes. And to exchange.
You got it, Glenn, for any questions or comments.
Yeah, it sounds a little bizarre to me. I mean, today most signal mixing and other things like that are done at the low frequency, the low power level, and most of it can be done digitally. I mean, I can understand why you'd want to add some tank circuits, but even still at the small signal level. Doing high power tuning like that sounds almost like 1950s designers. Sounds like an episode of Let's Go Back to the Future. Was Emmett Brown involved in any of this designing? I'm kind of interested what the application was, because it does sound kind of antiquated. Back to you, Dick. K4IW, K62QIQ.
Well, basically, it's a wafer technology. Wafer, and it's a technology from 2001. That's when this was done. There's a number of manufacturers. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, when you hear the description, it may sound old. When you look at the actual hardware, though, Glenn, it is it looks like 8-year-old technology in the method of construction. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, it's a wafer etching technology. I was in it for quite a while, so I kind of understand what's going on. Basically, it started in 60s and then evolved in 70s. It was a bell jar, which was a glass big bell, and there was a vacuum tube, and there was an etcher, and the lower electro and upper electro, and there was a wafer, which was the cylindrical small plate, and that's how they made all of these microprocessors, the first. With the advance of the technology, they change it to more accurate, and the robotic arm that was operating with it had to be changed. So that technology was simply outdated. Still, if somebody wants to buy the whole complete wafer, he can have it for approximately anywhere from $7,000 in working condition up to $500,000 in working condition. And yes, that part was basically a antenna tuner, and the second box, which is the smaller, was the it was a mixer. Dick, I have sent you another email a few days ago, which was a dozens of photographs showing exactly how it works, and another device from the same manufacturer, Tegel, which shows exactly in one unit how it works. You have 100 kilohertz in, you have 2.5 megahertz in, and then you have a product out. So basically 100 kilohertz is the modulating the frequency. Now in my protocol situation, the problem that I have with it is simply that if you look at two legs of the sort of transformer, the one pair of C with two coils on it, connected in series, it starts from the input, and the input is connected to two sets of it. But the output of one source of transformer is connected to the capacitor and ground, and the other one is connected to the capacitor and output. But so that's the only difference, and to exchange.
Are you saying that this was used as a vacuum deposition wafer manufacturing process? That this was some kind of intermediate piece of hardware used for vacuum deposition on wafer manufacture? Is that what you're saying, Wes?
Correct. It was working with the power anywhere, depends from the device, starting from 200 watts up to 50 kilowatts. And they were creating a spark with it, and the spark was actually with the mechanical arm directed to the wafer, and was actually burning the wafer. That's how they created that technology.
And because it was a real neat piece of science at an inexpensive price, you bought it, even though right now you're not quite sure how you're going to apply it. Is that sort of true, Wes?
I'm pretty sure how am I going to apply that. At first I bought it because of curiosity, but when I opened up, what was my my smile, the beauty of that smile when I saw two regulated cup transformers. Then when I spoke to Dick, I find out, no, we're not dealing with two transformers. We're dealing with the two C-shapes, two coils, but it's only one leg of the transformer. And the second motorized, the two C-shapes and two coils, again corrected in series, is the second part of the transformer. The input is connected to two wires from each one of the sets. The output is connected then to one only, because the C-shape of one is connected from input to the capacitor and to the ground, and the other one is connected to the capacitor and to the output.
And has anybody done any search yet on manufacturers, brand name, part numbers, and find a correlation of application brochure? In other words, have we found any data saying this is the way you use it and this is what it does?
Yes, you have it in your email.
So you found a source describing what it is and how to use it and what it does? Is that what you found, a document like that?
It's mostly by a comparison. If you go to your email and you look at the email from August 24, this is another device mixer of Tegel that I have used to solve mystery. And you look at the first picture, it's another device of Tegel. This one clearly shows J1 connector 100 kHz RF in. J2 connector 13.56 MHz RF in. And another connector combination RF out. That explains.
P62Z.
Go ahead, Hal.
Only to request, remember a couple of weeks ago there was discussion about a 62 transmitter putting out more, around 2 instead of 6.
Half of that was a dropout, maybe due to overmodulation. Want to ask the question again, Hal?
2 weeks ago, it was brought up about a Collins 62 transmitter that was putting out more power 2 meters and 6 meters. Remember that?
Sure do. Go right ahead, Hal.
Okay, I ran into that problem a few years ago. What it was a screen bypass ring was no good. Now what happens is when the screen bypass ring gets soft, you will get power up by the higher frequencies, but at a lower frequency it's going to degenerate.
Now the screen bypass capacitor,
Next tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Or perhaps a slippery finger, but the you lost the repeater a few times there. Anyway, sounds good. And I guess the weather should be good the next few days until that storm heads north.
Yeah, as it's supposed to head north, I haven't been tracking it.
Well, I guess eventually they do, but right now I guess it's drifting northwest towards the panhandle, I guess, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana coast there. I guess they're not quite sure where it's going to make landfall, but eventually as it goes inland, hopefully it'll deliver water where they need it. I'm sure it'll work its way up in our direction.
Well, you know, the water's one thing and the wind is another. Water's a good thing. The wind is not such a good thing. That's about it. Back to you.
Well, I guess they lose their intensity as a hurricane when they go inland. All that moisture and water continues for some time, so sounds like the southwest could use its wrenching anyway.
Yeah, okay. As far as the radio being repeater being quiet, I don't know. I had most of the days last week, almost every day, I spoke with Ted, a couple of times with Ron, and there was some new people who jumped in too, or people who haven't been on for a while who jumped in. There was a fella Rich, forgot the call sign again already, but he came in one day and he said we've chatted before. Ron and Ted seem to remember him. His call sign is kind of familiar, but my memory is going, so. I think it's possible you've been on a different schedule lately.
Perhaps some days. Could be. You know, some days I was in very early. Other days a bit later, so I guess maybe I was out of sync. And this morning maybe running 5 or 10 minutes a little later than usual. But things will be more routine, I guess, after the holiday.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not looking forward to after Labor Day and people coming back in. And I like more people on the air, but not more people on the road. Back to you. And then to use that deep ID.
Panic where I am. I don't know if it's my location or the repeater. Maybe it's not at full power, I don't know. Anyway, get a chance to do any HF?
No, not at all. Haven't gotten around to it, but soon, one of these days, I have all that equipment that really should get on HF. I'm about to go under the Gracie Square Mansion, so back to you.
All right. Well, we're just coming up to the ramp for the 3rd Avenue Bridge. So we're not too far behind you. And I guess if the traffic's not too bad, you should be starting to exit the tunnel.
Yeah, well, so that's under the tunnel here, but not too bad. I'm moving along at 30 miles an hour. So, back to you.
Interesting HF contacts this weekend. So I didn't get a lot of time on the radio. I spoke with a maritime mobile in the Southern Caribbean along the Venezuelan coast. And, let's see, another maritime contact on a yacht in Lake Pontchartrain, I guess, near New Orleans. Contacts to Hawaii. I gotta make room. I got an ambulance coming by here.
Okay. Very good. Then, what does your wife have to say about all the time you're spending on the radio?
Well, that's why there hasn't been that much time. I do it when she's doing something else, so I don't, or try to avoid engaging in that conversation. So she doesn't mind as long as she's preoccupied with something else.
Okay, I hear that. Okay, very nice, and okay. What else was I going to say? Very interesting. I got stopped for speeding in my town Friday morning. I took my wife's car for an oil change before we left, and I wasn't thinking. I was going a little too fast, and they got me on the radar. And the cop asked me if your wife was clean. I said, yeah. Okay. Comes back to me, says, well, you know, you're a local resident. You know, we're going to cut you a little slack. You know, you got a clean license. You don't want to mess it up. I'm going to give you a non-point ticket. Just plead guilty. Pay the $24 fine. And then he gave me another ticket because I couldn't find my wife's insurance card in the car. And then I found it when I got home. It was in there the whole time. Got to go to court on that one. Show that. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. So back to you.
Did you say $24? That was pretty light.
Yeah. You know, in Jersey, you can plead bargain tickets. So, you know, if you go to court and you have a clean record, usually you can plead bargain the ticket down anyhow. But they have a limit of twice for 5 years. But if the cop does it for you, then that doesn't count to it bad. So I still have my 2 shots in 5 years. Back to you.
Well, very good. I just noticing they've got a stage or something set up on Randall's Island. Passing 116th Street to the FDR. There must be some concert or something. Maybe it's for Labor Day weekend. Anyway, we're moving pretty well now in the FDR. Coming up on 106th. And did you hear Ron this morning, or Ted, or just the two of us?
Like it's just the two of us.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time holding the repeater, Nat. Maybe you got to put the tower up on your antenna.
Oh, all I said was I think it's just us. No, I got to check. I got to take this microphone apart and see if there's something loose in there. Back to you.
That's
noisy. I didn't copy that.
You're very hard to hear. You sound like DX.
Hold on a second. Is it still like that? Do I sound like DX?
I don't know if it's the repeater or maybe you're on a tower.
Kilo Alpha 1, Quebec and New Yankee.
Plus the problem could be at my end. Anyway, I'm just going under Gracie Mansion now.
You're very noisy. I thought I heard somebody else.
Says Kilo Alpha 1, Quebec, India, Yankee. My name is Joel. And the KGH is in Wellesley, Massachusetts.
What'd you say? You're coming in from Massachusetts? That's a long trip. Are you coming in on the IRLP? Or are you coming in on some kind of ducting or something?
I'm coming in on the A5 repeater in, on the PL of 135.3 hertz, 37.5. And my name is Joel, J-O-E-L.
Okay, Joe, what's your location?
Wellesley, Massachusetts. Wellesley. Whiskey, Echo, Lima, Lima, Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Okay, very good. I'm originally from Chelsea, Massachusetts. I know who Wellesley is. Very good. I didn't hear clearly. Are you coming in on the IRLP link, or are you coming in, direct into the repeater through a radio wave?
Because band open right now, I'm coming into on A5, 126A5. The PL is tone is 136.5. So back to you, KA1251.
Peter, pick it up.
Yeah, good morning, Wellesley, Massachusetts. I went to college at Brandeis, one of your neighboring towns there in Waltham. Name here is Peter, KC2KKX.
Hey, Peter, my name is Joel, J-O-E-L, and I have a brother named is Peter, too. I guess we're having a little bit of band opening on New York. Anyway, how do I make the repeater over?
You're making the repeater just fine. I think you might be making the repeater better than we are. We're pretty local. We're in New York City. Peter's in Manhattan right now. I'm in Queens, and the repeater is in the border of Queens and Long Island. I don't know if you're familiar with New York City geography. Peter?
Yeah, I'm about to pull in the garage here at 34th. So I'm going to wish you all a good day. And hope to be up on Cape Cod in a few weeks. And I'll say 73. Good day, Joel.
Okay, I'm going to tell you today about this band opening. This is a good band opening for coming to New York City on right now, about 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:23 right now. 7:23, KA1251.
Okay, 7:03, Peter, and yeah, Joel, I'll be in for another 5-10 minutes till I get to my office. I forgot. The name here is NAF, November Alpha Foxtrot, NAF. And the call sign is November 2, Uniform Zulu Delta, N2UZD.
Hey, very good, John. And, yeah, I'm running a Leico CJ 635T mobile radio, putting up 50 watts. I think it's a really nice antenna system, and I'm running about, I think it has some gate power into it, so it's probably get out pretty well. Anyway, this is a pretty good, this is, I think it's a major band opening from New York City up to Boston today. And I don't know what the weather's going to be. I think the weather's going to be hot again, I think.
Sorry, that was a little broken up. I didn't hear you, that last thing clearly.
I don't know if it's me or the band conditions shifted around with it. I guess I was close to full climbing, I used to think, but that was the best results I ever get on this repeater. How good it is this morning, it was coming in at like full 10.
Yeah, okay, your signal's starting to degrade a little bit now. There's something about the signal on the repeater, and this repeater has got very good coverage. In the metropolitan New York area. It's pretty high and it's in a good location. It's not abnormal to hit this repeater from 35, 40 miles away and get a good signal in. So, I